Up North News with Pat Kreitlow is a product of Courier Newsroom and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
Wisconsin Conversation, real information. Live from Lake Wissota, here is the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Happy Monday to you. Hope it was a good weekend. Producer Luke Mathers is here as well, and Dan Schaefer will join us in our next segment. Tomorrow, we have two candidates that we'll be talking to during the day. In the 8 o'clock hour, we will have Dick Ostman, candidate for Congress in the 7th District, and at 9 o'clock, Bob Look, candidate for State Senate in the 29th District. Over the weekend, Senator Ron Johnson was appearing with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss in Mount Pleasant to open up a new campaign office. And of course, that, you know, at first they said all the right things. We need to win this election. We need your support. The primary is behind us. Voss, you know, pulled out a squeaker, but he won, and everything went fine until, of course, somebody had to ask about, you know, election integrity. And this person said they were terrified that people were going to stuff ballot boxes and stuff the drop boxes and steal the ballots. Well, hello. As Adam Rogan points out in his story in the Journal Times, drop boxes are no longer a thing, thanks to Republicans. That convenience is gone. So there's no drop boxes to stuff. The ballot boxes can't be stuffed because they're staffed by amazing, thousands of amazing local election workers. The only people we know stealing ballots appear to be on the Republican side of the ledger. And yet, instead of setting that person straight, Ron Johnson said, "I share your concern." He said there. He said, "God bless the guy who had Robin's name and birthday and requested a ballot to a different address." In other words, he's saying, "God bless the guy." He's talking about Harry Waite, the right-wing activist from that area, who admitted to illegally obtaining an absentee ballot in the name of Robin Voss. And also in the name of Corey Mason, the mayor of Racine. And he could very likely face felony charges for that. He didn't face any charges right away from the Racine County Sheriff, Christopher Schmalling, because, of course, he's a Republican and, you know, buys into all of the right-wing talking points. But still, have a United States senator saying, "Thank goodness for the guy who tried to steal somebody else's ballot." I guess this shouldn't be the world's, you know, biggest surprise coming from somebody who almost brought an illegitimate ballot from of fake electors to Vice President Mike Pence on January 6th. But again, they're not as clever as they think they are. They think that they are exposing a flaw in the system, that, you know, you can use somebody else's name and birth date, you know, to obtain a ballot. Yeah, that's called theft. You know, again, you could steal somebody else's credit card and buy something, or their checkbook, or what have you. It doesn't mean you get rid of credit cards and checkbooks. It means you crack down on the people who are doing it illegally. And that's what Harry Waite hopefully will eventually face. I mean, the guy posted a video of himself committing the fraud, going over to the MyVote website and, you know, requesting that ballot. It's there. So Ron Johnson is saying, you know, thank God for this criminal, and that but the crime isn't what he claims it's been. Megan Wolf, the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, you know, has said intentionally using someone else's identity to subvert the system does not demonstrate a flaw with the system. It demonstrates a flaw with that person's conduct. And it demonstrates a flaw as well in Ron Johnson, who has continued to pass along often Russian-based misinformation about, you know, flaws in the American system of elections. He, you know, will continue to make the false claim that, you know, he said, quote, "Democrats want a system that makes it easy to cheat," when again, he knows better than that. Johnson went on to lament the lack of confidence that voters have in the system. Yeah, because people like you keep saying it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And usually that term is not meant literally, but that term is literal here. It is literally a self-fulfilling prophecy. It is something they set out to do to undermine confidence for whatever reason, whether it's to get more people who might vote Democratic to stay home because they think there's something wrong with the system, or it provides a convenient excuse to rig the system, or it's both. And in Johnson's case, it's both, because Johnson has come right out and said to Republican state legislators that they should just bypass the Wisconsin Elections Commission and take over administration of federal elections. That's, you know, something that they should just, well, seize. And again, these are the people that love to talk about, you know, that Democrats or liberals or socialists or communists or Bolsheviks or whatever it is want to seize things. The only people that are advocating seizing anything have been the acolytes of Donald Trump in Wisconsin and other states who have talked about seizing control of elections. It was part of the you know, the coup plot by Donald Trump to begin with, was to kick the election back to state legislatures controlled by Republicans and have them basically seize it and impose the results that they wanted rather than the will of the people. Well, between Ron Johnson's race and many more, we have a lot to talk about between now and November 8th, and we're going to talk about some of it with Dan Schaefer of the Recombobulation Area out of Milwaukee coming up next. You're up north. Talking about the Milwaukee airport and comments that former Governor Scott Walker made about how you can't find a bartender on a Sunday evening. There is an acknowledged professional about all matters surrounding the Milwaukee airport, so much so that he's named his column after it. It's called the Recombobulation Area, because that's the area where, and this is pure genius, as we await Dan Schaefer to join us. You might go, well, wait, Dan Schaefer calls his blog the Recombobulation Area? It's like, yeah, when you get through TSA, when you get through security, you feel all discombobulated. And if you know, you're always going to get a laugh the first time you see that they put up a sign just past the TSA checkpoint called the Recombobulation Area. And Dan has seized on that, used that for the name of his platform. And now, frankly, when people go through the Milwaukee airport, they will tag him in their posts. They'll use the hashtag or use Dan's handle about the Recombobulation Area. So Dan's a journalist from the Milwaukee area who has written extensively about politics. He's also written extensively about the Milwaukee Bucks. I mean, so much so that there are times I genuinely worry about him when things aren't going well. But we'll focus on the Bucks another time and just talk with Dan about last week's primary election. Hey, Dan, how are you?
Hey, Pat, doing well. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks so much for joining us. Pleasure to finally get to be able to chat with you face to face.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll go from, we'll make it a three-dimensional conversation sometime soon. But while we're talking through screens here, I was explaining, you know, the whole notion of the Recombobulation Area, because frankly, not a lot of people around Wausau, you know, fly through the Milwaukee airport. But, you know, which came first, the sign or the blog?
The sign came first, and it has been always one of my favorite random things in Milwaukee. And it's been kind of like this little local icon of sorts. And I actually did some research on the Recombobulation Area when I was back at Milwaukee Magazine for our Reasons to Love Milwaukee issue. And I found out some of its pretty interesting background. The former airport director in Milwaukee just came up with the idea for it on his own. And nowhere else in the world is there a Recombobulation Area. So it's all a credit to the former airport director in Milwaukee.
when I first saw that, well, first off, I laughed hard, like I'm sure a lot of people did. But then I was pretty convinced because I thought it was so clever. I kind of figured like it would get around, like, you know, TSA agents would tell each other about it. And eventually you would see that sign, you know, all over the place, kind of tongue in cheek. But instead, I think it's been like, you know, people have said that's Milwaukee's thing. Let them have it. So that's pretty cool.
And now it's
title of an award-winning new site and blog that, you know, is essential reading for Wisconsin politics and also for all things Milwaukee. And Dan, if you'll forgive the brief tangent, but again, to explain to the listeners that while, you know, this is a show coming to you from Lake Wissota, from somebody proud to live in Chippewa Falls, this is somebody who has also lived in Rice Lake, who has worked and campaigned and reported throughout northern Wisconsin, but who has also lived in Milwaukee. Both my kids were born in Milwaukee, have had a couple of jobs down there, same as in Madison. So unlike a lot of the state, I'm one of these people who is just a shameless champion for both, and that frankly, both rural Wisconsin and Milwaukee need each other, need to appreciate each other better. And so we're going to talk a bit about that in one of the areas of your top 10 list, well, not top 10, but 10 takeaways from last week's Republic or Wisconsin primary. And number one on the list, frankly, didn't get talked about enough last week. I mean, people noted it, but I mean, it really is stunning, the collapse of Rebecca Clefish in a relatively short time. Somebody that had been chasing the governor's post basically since the day Scott Walker lost. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised that it's number one on you know your column here as well.
Yeah, I think it's the biggest story to emerge from Tuesday's primary is that you know, the collapse of her campaign, that she had this 3.5 year head start ahead of Tim Michaels, had been campaigning basically since, like you said, since the moment Scott Walker lost in 2018, and, you know, had the backing of a lot of the establishment Republicans who have been largely running the state for the better part of the last 12 years. You talk about people like Scott Walker, Robin Voss, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the Tavern League. So you had a lot of that. A lot of the people who had been in charge had endorsed her to try to, you know, continue this trajectory that Wisconsin conservatives have done over the past, you know, basically since 2010. And, you know, Michaels comes in and upends that race pretty quickly. I mean, you know, we only it was as recently as what, April, that she was just the overwhelming front runner ahead of Kevin Nicholson and Tim Ramphin. Michaels comes into the race, spends a bunch of money on TV, gets the Trump endorsement. It doesn't even seem like he had to, you know, fight a super difficult primary, and ended up winning by a fairly significant margin in a race that a lot of people, you know, even going into the results, thought might be a toss up. And I think that really, you know, it's a rejection of that Republican establishment. And I think it's a rejection of, you know, just the way that she ran her campaign too. I thought it was a very poorly run campaign as well. And I thought, you know, I wrote a preview of the race a little over a year ago and saying that I thought she was a formidable candidate. And I thought if she would be running against Tony Evers, given the typical midterm dynamics for Republicans, she'd be the favorite. But I think she just ran an awful campaign and voters shifted away from her as the campaign unfolded, and Michaels had a pretty decisive victory, I think. You know, I think we can get into to where he won as well.
Yeah, we absolutely will. I will note though, and again, a lot has changed in 12 years, but there was a striking parallel to, you know, Ron Johnson coming out of nowhere in 2010, where again, the party was looking for something new. Then, you know, here comes somebody with a bunch of money. And they basically defer to him. And it seems like that same kind of deference to, you know, a wealthy, you know, self-funded candidate, you know, who would use all the right buzzwords, meant more than any establishment person who had hit all the chicken dinners, who had done all the right things with the insiders. But elections are decided by more than just the people that go to county party meetings.
Mm-hmm. And I think you saw over the course of, you know, the year that Clefish was running as the runaway front runner, you know, there were all these stories about different potential candidates who might jump into the race. You had, you know, Trump wanting Sean Duffy to get into the race. We heard, you know, Bill McCaution, who ended up working for the Michaels campaign, Eric Hovde, Reince Priebus, Tommy Thompson, all these different names that Republicans who were not sold on Clayfish had kind of cycled through before they landed on Michaels. And, you know, it sure helps that he had, you know, a few million dollars of his own money that he could help self-fund his campaign. And then once he got the Trump endorsement, it seemed like it was all over from there.
You note number two on your list is, you know, how incredibly strong Tim Michaels' performance was across rural Wisconsin. And I mean, it makes me wonder about this. He clearly dominated in the primary. He put, you know, something like $10 million of his own money in there. But he has also, you know, committed some gaffes. He's committed some flip-flops. And I don't think the issue of him being essentially a Connecticut carpetbagger is going to go away. So I wanted to know the state of that race. I mean, Michaels obviously was strong in rural Wisconsin in a primary, but how do you assess, you know, Tim Michaels and Tony Evers, you know, moving forward?
Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting campaign. You're already seeing kind of the pivot from the Michaels camp toward the general election race. And, you know, I think the rural urban divide is going to be played up to a large degree. Obviously, like you said, you saw Michaels do really, really well in rural Wisconsin. He won 62 counties of the 72 Wisconsin counties. And even in the, you know, kind of the Waukesha County, the Wow County area that you know, has been the typical kind of Walker Clayfish stronghold, Michaels did, you know, really cut into the margins there. And so I think that's interesting too. And then I think as you get to the race with Evers, I think, you know, I think Evers tends to be underestimated. And I think he, you know, people underestimated him in 2018. And I think people have underestimated him throughout his time as governor. And, you know, he's a pretty popular moderate governor for a swing state. And I think that is going to help him. You know, he's been kind of a stabilizing force in Wisconsin as the Republicans have gone further and further and further to the right. And you saw, you know, Tim Michaels adopt some of those very far right positions as he got into the primary, being very far to the right on guns, being very far to the right on abortion, being very far to the right on a number of these issues, you know, election, the quote unquote election integrity. To get the Trump endorsement and things like that. I wonder if that is the type of politics that's going to win him the primary, but be a problem for him in the general election.
Exactly. And, you know, in terms of underestimating Tony Evers, I just feel like people have forgotten Jim Doyle won twice. And then several times before that for like attorney general, Jim Doyle, nobody's idea of, you know, of a fireworks show. I mean, right. he got the job done, you know, and people saw that. They saw he was steady, nothing flashy about him. And so, no, I'm not the least bit surprised that it's Tony Evers. I was surprised, however, that Mandela Barnes, a sitting lieutenant governor, would say, well, I know you're going to run for re-election, Governor Evers, but, you know, I see this opportunity. I'm going to go here. I, of course, no idea how the race was going to go, but, you know, and I really did not see everybody, all the other candidates pulling out near the end. But, you know, you ended up writing something that was picked up in the New York Times last week that was, you know, the part biography of explaining why we all shouldn't be surprised about Mandela Barnes, not just, you know, his record to get here, but that this marks a real, you know, generational watershed in politics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I think we can get into this after your break coming up here, but I think the Mandela Barnes candidacy is going to be the Johnson Barnes race in general is just going to be an absolutely fascinating one to watch. And I think, you know, people underestimated Evers before. I think people underestimate Barnes too. And I think part of that is the generational component. I think millennials in general tend to be underestimated in a lot of ways.
I think that we're, I said at the time, we're long past, you know, the need to have senators in their 80s, and maybe it's about time we have senators who were born in the 80s.
That's right. That's right. There's only one of them right now, John Ossoff of Georgia. Mandela Barnes would be the second.
Schaefer is our... races for governor, for U.S. Senate, but also for legislature and one particular congressional district that is, you know, going to be watched all across the nation. So stick around for more with Dan Schaefer. I'm Pat Kreitlow. You're up north.
From Lake Wissota, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Talking to Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation area about takeaways from the Wisconsin primary election last week as we move into the general. And before the break, we were talking a bit about Dan's piece in the New York Times about Mandela Barnes and what he represents. And Dan, it's that significance of what he represents from a generational standpoint, I think more than makes up for this attack that Ron Johnson and others are launching at him now that his resume is somehow thin. Now, set aside how disingenuous that is, given that Ron Johnson's political experience was zero when he got elected to the U.S. Senate. What is it that Mandela brings to the campaign that overcomes whatever thinness might be in that resume?
Yeah, I think, for one, I think that criticism is a difficult one when you have Mandela Barnes, who became the first Black lieutenant governor in the state's history at the age of 31. I think that's a pretty significant accomplishment. But also, I think there's going to be a distinct generational component to this race where I think Johnson has, you know, he has been an obstructionist in a lot of ways in the Senate. And he has stood in the way of progress in a lot of ways in the Senate. And I think younger generations want to see more urgency. They want to see more action. And I think that's the type of thing that Barnes can bring to this. He has put wanting to eliminate the filibuster front and center in his campaign. And I think most millennials who have come of age in a time of crisis, whether it's the 9/11 and the Iraq War, whether it's the Great Recession, whether it's the pandemic, you know, people want to see more urgent action from Congress. And I think that's going to be a part of it as well. And I think Barnes also, you know, just with the representation factor, he will represent millennials in Congress in a way that they are not being represented right now. You know, the Senate, as it's currently constructed, is the oldest it has ever been. There are one third of the members are over the age of 70, and there are roughly as many members in their 80s as there are under the age of 50. So there needs to be more representation to speak to this, you know, this generation who has come of age in crisis and wants to see more urgent action on climate change, on healthcare, on so many issues. So I think that is going to be a huge part of this campaign. Is that generational divide between a 35-year-old Black millennial and a 67-year-old two-term Republican senator.
And what also I think bodes well for Mandela Barnes is that the Republican Party in Wisconsin and elsewhere remains quite fractured. I mean, you know, the cliche is always Democrats in disarray. But, you know, you note in three different ways, Robin Voss nearly lost, Adam Jarko lost, and of course, Tim Time is no longer a thing here in Wisconsin, because you have that party that I certainly don't, I'm not saying that, you know, every Republican voter is going to stay home. I'm not saying that by any stretch of the imagination. This is not a unified party heading into the general.
No, it is not. And you saw some of those fractures in the primary, particularly like with Clay Fish losing, with Voss almost losing, which I didn't even think it would be close for that one. So I think, you know, they keep debating themselves over the 2020 election. And I think, you know, Tim Michaels in his speech with Donald Trump said election integrity was his number one issue. And then a week later after the election, he said jobs and the economy is his number one issue. Mm-hmm. So it remains to be seen if the Clayfish camp, if the Voss camp will get behind Michaels in as much of a way as they might have with Clayfish. But I think you also have to recognize the reality of the midterm dynamics. And the reality of the midterm dynamics is the party opposite the president does well in the midterms every time. The only exception to that over the past 30 years was in 2002, when President George W. Bush's approval rating was sky high after 9/11. So I think you have to recognize the reality of that. And I think, you know, Republicans in a swing state like Wisconsin are going to be favored in a lot of these 50-50 races. But I think the dynamic that I kind of alluded to in the piece and I am seeing in this race is this might not be your typical midterm election year for a number of reasons. So
I definitely believe that for, yes, a host of reasons. And that schism in the party, you know, was put on display even more than we thought it was. It wasn't just Trump versus Pence in terms of Clayfish and Michaels. But then, you know, late that night and then throughout the rest of the week, it was put on display as Voss versus Gabelman, which, you know, then the week ended with Voss letting Gabelman go. And Voss initially said he was going to have maybe a meeting of the Republican caucus and decide on this. And then he said, well, I've talked to enough people on the phone and elsewhere, and I'm just going to fire him on his own. Did you expect that to happen earlier, like Wednesday or Thursday, or that Voss would, you know, bite his lip and let Gabelman continue to operate?
I thought he would let Gabelman continue to operate, because I think one of the things that has stood out in some of the Marquette polling this year is the polling on enthusiasm. And, you know, they'll identify that there's an enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats, and the Republicans have more enthusiasm for this. But among those enthusiastic Republicans, the most enthusiastic Republicans are people who are most fired up about the lie of a stolen election. So I think you risk alienating the base voters of the pro-Trump election denying base voters in Wisconsin, of which there are obviously many. I mean, I think the majority of members of the state legislature at this point have paid lip service to wanting to overturn the 2020 election results. And so I think you had to have some sort of political calculation there for Voss. I don't know. Were you surprised as well? I'm trying to get some reaction to this from people, but.
Well, I'll be honest enough to say that I'd gone a little too far one way, and it probably simply from A, being in the legislature, and B, you know, maybe I was secretly hoping for some drama. But when Voss mentioned that he was going to have a caucus, I asked a few of our guests last week if perhaps Voss might be in for an unpleasant surprise, that he might actually get in that caucus meeting and think, okay, let's get Gabelman out of here. And that enough people would say, you know, actually, Robin, we don't have confidence in you anymore. And I mean, I'm still going to tell you, I don't know if maybe that was part of the calculation why there wasn't a caucus this week, that he simply, you know, claimed to have talked to enough members and did it by phone. I don't know how strong Voss is standing in that caucus is and what it will be like come January, whatever the result.
Yeah, I think Voss, as we've seen so many times in Wisconsin politics, is very petty, is very vindictive. Mm-hmm. And I think he's doing this not because of any other reason, but the fact that Gabelman campaigned against him. That's the only reason.
Oh, yeah. I mean, without that, we wouldn't see this at all. I want to leave time to talk with Dan Schaefer about the third congressional district and how important it is. But I'm going to jump ahead again to something that probably is not talked about much up north, but again, because of my own background, I want to bring this up to folks. And that is a couple of Democratic socialists who have won races in the Milwaukee area. And the reason I want to bring this up with Dan is he does a masterful job of explaining how Milwaukee, the largest cog in the state's economic engine, is vilified, demonized, punished like no other big city is by its state legislature, and that something was going to have to change in terms of, you know, what Milwaukee voters were going to do. And so when you hear, wait, they're electing Democratic Socialists in Milwaukee, I mean, they're just not doing politics as usual. And that certainly came out in the case of candidate Darren Madison Jr., who topped Glendale Mayor Brian Kennedy, you know, a white suburban candidate on the Democratic side. So, Dan, I mean, just give our listeners briefly just how badly, you know, Milwaukee is hurting because of the legislature and whether you thought that might have played a role in these primaries.
Yeah, I think it's a huge, huge factor of just Milwaukee's response to a lot of these legislative races and things like that, because the state legislature has just constantly defunded and demonized Milwaukee. The city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County are facing major, major budget shortfalls over the next several years because of the way the state legislature has cut shared revenue and eliminated options for local control. And so I think there are a number of factions and coalitions within Milwaukee that are starting to form, that are starting to find different ways to push back against this. And so I think Darren Madison is an interesting example because he was an organizer with the African-American Roundtable and was endorsed by BLOC, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, and had aligned with the Democratic Socialist Group in Milwaukee. And so he was also endorsed by David Bowen, who was the current representative in that 10th Assembly District. So I think that some interesting coalitions are emerging in Milwaukee. And so we will see most likely two Democratic Socialists in the legislature next year. The other being Ryan Clancy, who ran unopposed in the primary for the seat that is going to be vacated by Jonathan Brostoff, who is going to the Milwaukee Common Council. And Ryan Clancy has been a representative in the Milwaukee County Board. He's actually gotten some really interesting legislation passed there as well, one giving a right to counsel for people who are evicted. So I think, you know, you're seeing some interesting actions on the local level that with the few resources that Milwaukee is allowed to try and really make a difference for people.
And Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation area is joining us. And I want to end with, you know, I'm looking at something far away from me down in Milwaukee. And now I want to see how you, being in Milwaukee, view what's happening in the 3rd Congressional District in Western and part of Central Wisconsin with Republican Derek Van Orden, who was, I like to say, insurrection adjacent, facing off now with State Senator Brad Paff. And we know what a 50-50 district is, and we know what the midterm trends are like. But what is your view of it from your corner of the state?
Yeah, I think it's going to be the most competitive congressional race by far because of how redistricting is in Wisconsin and the fact that, Republicans are going to control a majority of the congressional districts in the state. But I think this is a particularly interesting one with Ron Kind retiring, you know, in the 2020 election. Kind obviously won, but that was a district that Trump carried as well. So it is kind of one of those swing regions. We saw a kind of shift from Obama to Trump in recent years. I thought it was, you know, I didn't get to follow it that closely, but it seemed like a pretty interesting primary. And Brad Paff, you know, he won a pretty close election in 2020 that was crucial to saving Governor Evers' veto. And so I think it's going to be quite the contrast. There's so many really stark contrasts between candidates in so many races. And I think Brad Paff and Derek Van Orden, who is an unhinged insurrectionist, is going to be something else.
Well, I mean, again, it's that whole notion of this is a state that gave us Joseph McCarthy, you know, but it also gave us Gaylord Nelson and the La Follettes. The contrasts here are just, I mean, no wonder the New York Times wanted to hear from you and have at least some kind of an explanation of how these things work. If people want to hear more from you on a more regular basis, how do people reach the Recombobulation area? How do they best read what you're doing?
Yeah, you can. The Recombobulation area is a weekly newsletter that publishes on Substack. So you can subscribe to get that newsletter for free in your inbox. You could also become a paid subscriber to help fund the work that we do. We're growing. We're aiming to do more and more over the next few months and on into the future here. So, and you can also, of course, find me on Twitter at Dan R. Schaefer, where I'm occasionally tweeting about things other than the Bucks.
Well, I don't know, man. I need your 15-second analysis. How should we feel heading into the season here?
I'm excited. We've got Giannis. Chris Middleton's coming back. We're going to be good.
Okay. That's all we needed to hear. Chris Middleton is back. So we'll go from there. Dan, this was such a pleasure. Thanks. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. Have a great day. Dan Schaefer, again, from the Recombobulation area. We will take a break. We will wrap up this hour's conversation in just a moment. You're up north. So since we had one super fan for the Bucks and Dan Schaefer, we move on to Sheryl Crow, who I was trying to remember why she was such a big Bucks fan. And it was in part because her then 11-year-old son during the championship run was just such a big fan of Giannis and of Chris Middleton. And so, you know, hopefully we keep those guys healthy coming up in the next season and, you know, bring another championship banner to Wisconsin. That would be very cool.
I think I could settle for every other year. I mean, they've got the core component. And if they did it, every year is kind of greedy. And you can't expect that. It's hard to repeat. But like every other year, the Golden State Warriors did it for a little while. And there's been other teams to have done it. So I think I'm going to try to settle for every other year. I expect the Bucks to bring home one of those banners.
And then, well, if you do it every other year, how many times do you have to do that to constitute a dynasty? You know, is Golden State a dynasty because they've done it every other year? Are the San Francisco Giants, you know, a dynasty because they've done it every other year? I don't know. I don't know if that constitutes one, but you'll still take it.
It's close. I would say that Golden State is, if Golden State gets one more in the next two or three years here with Steph Curry and that core that they have out there in San Francisco and Oakland, I would constitute that a dynasty. They're like right on the borderline right now, but I think one more would seal that.
I do not know, and I don't know if data indicates, you know, where Wisconsin's NBA fans are. Wisconsin fandom is kind of funny all the way around. There's still plenty of Chicago Cubs fans, you know, because again, the Cubs long predate the Milwaukee Brewers. And then from a basketball standpoint, while I'm sure there's Bucks fans up north here, I'm sure others became Minnesota Timberwolves fans once Minnesota got an NBA team. Although calling the Timberwolves an NBA team, you know, is kind of putting it generously, given, you know, what their postseason, you know, history has been.
This past postseason was really exciting, though. It was fun to watch, but they've kind of made a lot of different changes now with the big trade to Salt Lake earlier this year. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Timberwolves. But I'm always fascinated by Wisconsin sports. I follow all the Wisconsin teams. I wish we had a hockey team because I think I'd be a little bit more into hockey, but I don't have a home for
I wish there was team. Too, because my son-in-law is from the Milwaukee area and is a huge Chicago Blackhawks fan. And I can't possibly tolerate that. You know, again, from somebody from Western Wisconsin, you know, born in the Twin Cities, there's only, you know, a certain group of teams you can't root for. You can't root for the Blackhawks or the Bears or the White Sox. It's just not allowed. So I'd love for him to be a Wild fan, but better yet, yeah, if the Milwaukee Admirals could have, you know, made it to the NHL or some other NHL team here, that'd be great. The back to the basketball, the dynamic I find interesting is that you don't have tons of Milwaukee Bucks fans, at least prior to this championship run, but man, the state high school basketball tournament, I mean, that captivates people. People follow that, you know, every year. That's the one thing. They'll sit down and become little experts, like we all are when we watch the Olympics. You know, we become experts in the short term. And so people love their high school basketball tournament, but and of course the you know, the Badgers or Marquette, but it hasn't really carried over into the NBA nearly as much. But you still get I was just hearing from somebody who, you know, whose son's name was Jordan, of course, for Michael Jordan from back in the day. I don't know if Giannis is really catching on as a baby name. I could be wrong. Maybe it is. Somebody check the records. But the Washington Post recently did a deep data dive on what are the most regretted baby names, the names that get changed the most. And this was brought about because of, which ridiculous Kardashian was it? Was it Kylie Jenner? Let me see if I can find it here. You know, Kylie Jenner.
I can't help you with that one because I do not keep up with the Kardashians. So I'm sorry.
She and Travis Scott actually changed their child's name. In February, they named their baby Wolf. And then later on, Jenner said, we just didn't really feel like that was him. And so the baby's new name has not been shared. So it got them thinking, you know, where are the most changed or what are the most changed baby names? So looking at Social Security records from 2017 to March of 2022, do you want to take a guess of one that's on one of these top 10 lists of a name that was later changed?
Donald.
Donald. Oh, that's a good guess. Yeah,
that's my guess.
I don't know that there's a lot of Donalds anymore anyway. So no, that one is that's not on the list, but that's a solid guess. So they did it in two different ways. Most changed names for, you know, for babies, and then most changed of babies who were adopted, where they changed the names. Interestingly, the same names are on both lists for boy and a girl. Number one and number two of the most changed names, adopted or otherwise, Isaac and Chloe. So a lot of people named, well, I shouldn't say a lot. Let's see. It's 30,000 babies in the past 5 years. So this 5 years of data they looked at, 30,000 parents changed the first name of their babies. And Isaac and Chloe were big on that list. I know at least one Isaac. I guess I don't see that as something you'd name your baby and then reject, but
I got a buddy Isaac too. And I think he likes his name. Yeah.
So going down first, the most changed names of adopted babies. Number 10 was Jonathan. Number 9, Connor. 8 was Matthew. 7, Elijah. 6, Michael. Number 5, Olivia. Number 4, William. Number 3, Sebastian. And then Chloe, and then Isaac. And for biological births, number 10 was David. A lot of people name their child David, probably to make somebody's father happy. You got to make your grandfather happy. And, then said no. Number 9 was Sophia. Didn't get to stick around. Isabella, number 8. They changed that name. Number 7 was James. 6, Michael. Number 5, Elliot. Number 4, Connor. Number 3, Aiden. And then Chloe, and then Isaac. And so then the Washington Post did reach out to a lot of these parents just to ask, you know, what, why? And it's funny. So many of them said what I guess I expected them to say is like, well, he just didn't look like a Michael, you know, or she just didn't look like a Chloe. How do you know? They're a baby.
This reminds me from The Office when, like, Andy Bernard, Ed Helms' character, like, was previously named Junior. Like, he had his dad's name, and then he had a little brother, like, 8 years later, and they changed his name, and they gave the younger son the Junior name instead. And, like, how do you do that? How do you go through and change your child's name when they've been named that for years? How does that work?
I know. You're... Well, I mean, look, and other people have given their kids ridiculous names. You know, Elon Musk, you know, named his with some kind of a math symbol or something like that. And all our babies deserve some care and consideration. This is Pat. Still check. Let me check my ID. Yep, still Pat Kreitlow. You're up north. We'll be back after this.